you know, there's this new lens, and it's like, okay, everything starts to make sense when you look over it with the lens of autism. It's like all these things that were confusing, you know, it's like, okay.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Adult and Autistic Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Grant, and today I'll be in conversation with Krista, or as you may know her, Neurodivergent Rebel. We talk about workplace adjustments, friends, socialising with autism, as well as stimming. Today's episode is going to be a really good one. I think you're going to love, and yeah, let's just get into it. So Krista, tell me a bit about yourself.
So I was diagnosed autistic at the age of 29, and I was also diagnosed with social anxiety. However, now with more of a vocabulary in mental health and more of a better understanding of anxiety, I'd say probably generalized anxiety would have been more accurate looking back.
How long, like, what was your diagnosis experience? What made you think to go and seek help?
So I had been struggling with a health problem that kept coming back over and over again at different times in my life. And now in hindsight, I would say that was autistic burnout. I was pushing myself really hard to fit into, you know, a box that I wasn't really meant to fit into. You know, one of my autistic strengths is, you know, if I really am in love with something, I can usually, and I really put my head to it, I can do it, you know, if I want to bad enough. And I had a job that I really thought was my dream job, and they needed me to be someone I really wasn't and couldn't be. And so the masking from that and just constantly pushing myself really hard, you know, the square peg in the round hole, I was making myself sick, and I started having neurological symptoms and some stomach issues, and I really was not in a good place mentally or physically. And after dealing with my GP, I kept going back a few different times. Eventually, I was referred out to a psychologist because she said, I think you're having anxiety. And I had coincidentally stumbled upon writings from an autistic adult around that same time. And I asked the doctor, hey, can I also, maybe if I'm going to see a psychologist anyway, if you don't think it's something physical, can I see someone who at least knows about autism? And the doctor kind of laughed at me and was like, well, you know, I really don't think you're autistic, but sure. You know, so she gave me some phone numbers, and I looked through the list, and I'd seen the advice that you should look for someone who has experience with adult diagnosis specifically. And so I found someone in my area that wasn't too far away that had experience with adult diagnosis, and then also was someone who had experience with anxiety, since that was what the doctor actually said they thought was my problem, which of course anxiety is a problem, without a doubt. And so I went through, and, you know, it's a bit of a long process. You go in, and I had a bunch of typed notes, and just memories and things that I thought were worth addressing and noting. And then I also had some contact information from some people who knew me growing up. One of those was my grandmother, and, you know, childhood friends, things like that. And, you know, I had my appointment with the doctor, and then I went home, and I think for a couple of weeks she took the time to interview the people that I had given her to investigate, you know, like my childhood and growing up, and how I am in the workplace, things like that. To verify, you know, that I've always been the way I've been. I forgot also I had baby videos. So I took those too. So I was like a very well-documented child, which thank goodness made this easy for me, because I've heard it can be difficult for people if they either don't have people in their lives that can reflect back on their childhood or any childhood footage or anything like that. But I was really, really lucky to have all of those things. And so, you know, I went back about 2 weeks later and received the autism diagnosis. And I think, you know, what was really important for me, and I'm so grateful, beyond words grateful, is that the person who diagnosed me didn't paint autism as something that was wrong with me. She didn't, you know, I was like, oh, okay, you know, and I even kind of said, oh, this is what's wrong with me. She's like, no, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, you just have a different way of looking at the world. You've got a different type of brain, and it's okay. And I'm so glad And then the other thing that she did that was extremely valuable was she recommended books written by autistic voices and autistic authors. And so set me on that path towards looking at information, firsthand information, instead of all of that gloom and doom and horrible stuff you find if you like start typing in Google and don't look very far, because the stuff that comes up right on top is all pretty negative and really terrible.
With that being said, do you remember any of the books that she mentioned and suggested to you?
Yeah, the very first one, and I might not get the title exactly correct, but I believe it was Women from Another Planet. And it was like a collection of autistic women between, I think, the ages of like 20 to 40. And there was just their life stories. And reading all of the different life stories, it was so interesting to me because even though they were all different people, there were all of these things that I related to that were things that I thought were just these weird little things about me that were quirks I had that nobody else in the world could possibly understand, you know, just my, and it was so weird to see that those things like over and over again with these other people who, you know, were strangers, but had so much in common with me. I remember it was just really jarring.
So like looking towards your life now, what's your day-to-day life set up like? What do you do for a job, home life, what sort of stuff like?
So when I was diagnosed, I really changed around everything in my lifestyle. It wasn't easy because I found that even though I, you know, I started to go back over my life and comb through my details and the life events, and you know, there's this new lens and it's like, okay, everything starts to make sense when you look over it with the lens of autism. It's like all these things that were confusing. You know, I was like, okay. You know, as I got deeper into it, oh my gosh, I just had a total brain like moment. Steer me back with the question again. Thank you so much.
Well, it's all right. You were talking about life before your diagnosis and life after diagnosis and how you changed your lifestyle around.
Yes. So, you know, there was resistance with people in my life who had known me before my diagnosis at first, because, you know, I was really trying to change my life and respect the new needs that I've always had but didn't know I had. And so a lot of people really saw me the same way they'd always seen me. And so that was a little bit difficult, especially like with work and the employer. You know, when they hired me, they hired someone, quote, without a disability, because I didn't know I had a disability. And, you know, I'm asking for accommodations and trying to get people to help me make changes. And, you know, I've got people pushing back at first saying, you know, you never asked for this before. Why do you need this now? And it's like, you know, all of those things. But eventually, you know, once I got a little bit more skilled in navigating these areas, because I think a lot of my requests originally when they were denied at first were probably because I didn't get the point across in a very nice way. But then once I started to figure out how to redesign my world, I really did that. You know, my partner and I, we were living in a house, and now we live in an RV, which is the roaming sensory bubble, I call it. That's also great for executive functioning because it's a really small space. So, you know, when you get burnout or you're having executive functioning issues, like chores kind of are not on top of mind. But then with the RV, even if stuff gets really messy, it's a very small space, so you can go back through and clean it pretty quickly, you know, if you need to, which is nice, and it's less to keep track of. But then also, you know, the roaming sensory bubble, no matter where I go, if I need to take a break or be somewhere I feel safe and secure, it's always there, so that's really nice. But then my job, too, you know, I've completely changed my job, my career. I was going to a job where I would commute every day, and it would be at least maybe an hour to 2 hours each way. And driving is something that I can do, but it's not easy for me. And especially with traffic or going somewhere unfamiliar. And so that would really wear me out. The traffic around here didn't used to always be that bad. We're near Austin and it's a really booming, growing place. But unfortunately now, you know, you spend a lot of time sitting in traffic. And for me, you know, I would get to work after 2 hours in traffic and I would already be like mentally worn out and tired and needing a nap. And it's like, oh, my workday's got to start now. And that was really draining. And so I don't commute anymore, which is great. I have a new employer and, you know, I was diagnosed autistic, you know, before I was hired at one job. And so at my next employer, I was determined to be really upfront and open and honest and disclose during the diagnostic process. But it wasn't a huge secret because the person who hired me actually sat on the board of an autism charity with me. So they knew I was autistic anyway from that capacity. So that was like all these stars aligned. It's like, you know, magical, serendipitous luck, a lot of it. But so now I've got the new employer who is, you know, just really just willing to accommodate me, and I work remotely, and we do have face-to-face meetings here and there from time to time, but we don't go sit next to each other just for the sake of sitting next to each other for no good reason. And, you know, having just being fully supported at work and at home, and, you know, even like, you know, there are people I've cut out of my life since being diagnosed. The people, you know, like I said, that had trouble accepting that I was kind of changing and that I was evolving because of this diagnosis, those people, unfortunately, some of them are no longer with me, or some of the people I was closer to before my diagnosis, I'm no longer close to because I realized, you know, I was masking and I didn't want to do that anymore. And some people didn't like who I was when I wasn't masking, and those weren't my people. So it's been a really interesting and almost, you know, traumatic in a good and a bad way process going through it. But it really, you know, looking back, I'd say saved my life and got me on track, because gosh, I've burned myself out so many times and made myself sick so many times in my life. You know, it's something that's happened over and over again. But now, you know, I know what it is. I see it happening, and I know how to better take care of myself. And I make a point to make, you know, that self-care a scheduled priority even sometimes, you know, because I have the reason, and to, not an excuse, but like I know, like a reason to stand up for myself and say, I really do need this. When before it was like I was always giving to other people's needs because people were telling me my needs were unreasonable. Which is terrible. You know, society's always unintentionally gaslighting autistic people, I think, which is really sad.
You just want to explain what gaslighting is for those who don't know?
Yeah. So gaslighting, unfortunately, you know, a lot of people talk about gaslighting with abusive relationships where you have a partner or someone who lies and twists things around to make you feel like maybe the reality that you are witnessing isn't real or isn't happening. And they'll say things like, oh no, you know, you're crazy. That never happened. And I don't know what you're talking about. And they'll twist you around and make you doubt, you know, reality until, you know, you feel like your experience of reality isn't valid or accurate. And it really makes you, you know, if you experience too much gaslighting, it's hard on your self-esteem, and you just always doubt yourself because you feel like you can't trust yourself to make good decisions. And so, you know, I think it's a really big problem with autistic people because, you know, we have different needs, and people are constantly telling us, oh, you know, that's not necessary. You don't really need that. Or can't you try a little harder? Or you're not trying your hardest. And it's really devastating for a lot of us.
So you mentioned that a lot of the people that you were friends with before, like you're no longer friends with, or people that you've cut out of your life because of your now changed behaviours. So what types of things were you doing before that you no longer take part in now? And what do you replace those activities with?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, I used to, like, especially when I was younger too, or I'd go out and maybe try to go to bars or try to go to clubs. And, you know, I realized, you know, one, alcohol doesn't really agree with me, so I stopped drinking a while ago. But I realized, you know, when I stopped drinking, period, I was only drinking when I went out because the social situations were so intolerable for me, you know? And so I was constantly putting myself into situations that were stressful or uncomfortable, or I didn't really even want to be there or go to, you know, because I kept getting myself to things, and I'd be like, when I get there, I'd be like, why am I here? I don't even like this, you know, because it was what my friends wanted, or, you know, my coworkers, or, oh, come on, so we need to go to this happy hour after work, or, you know, and it's like, this isn't even fun for me. But if I didn't go, I, you know, before, people would be like, oh, well, you don't like us, you never want to come out, or, you know, it was just, I stopped, you know, I started having more boundaries and being willing to say no to things I didn't enjoy. And then also, you know, something just with masking is mm-hmm. being more honest with things that make me uncomfortable, or, you know, when I need help, or when I'm struggling, or when I'm confused about something. In a lot of those social situations, you know, in the past when I would go, you know, say like a happy hour or something, it's like I'm going and I'm sitting across the table with these people, but, you know, with auditory processing issues, I can't understand half of what they're saying. By the time I get out of there, I'm going to feel sick and miserable. You know, I'm there only for them. And unless it's a really special occasion, it's like I wasn't even enjoying the activities I did with those people when we went out, because it was like we were always, you know, doing things that everyone else wanted to do. Instead of, you know, caring about my needs, because I thought my needs were so, or my desires or my wants were so obscure that nobody wants to do what I want to do. So I just did what everyone else wanted to do a lot.
So what do you do now?
What do I do now? I am much more contently and proudly a recluse. My, you know, I have Dave, my friend, my best friend and partner in crime, and he is, you know, my human, And, you know, when I was growing up, too, it was kind of similar where, you know, I would have one close friend at a time and I would really get to know that person so well. So I would know all of their ins and outs, because new people are actually more tricky for me. You know, I can actually read David's facial expressions and read his body language. Whereas with new people and strangers, I can pick up on certain things if I'm like really, really like focused on it, because I've only learned to start reading body language since I was diagnosed in my 30s, because I was like obsessed with, oh my God, there are all these nonverbal things. I had no idea. Like it just didn't occur to me until I was diagnosed. And like now I pick up on it more than I used to, but it's not natural. And so it's really interesting. I just got off track again. Steer me.
No, that was on track.
Okay. Steer me. Yes. Oh, executive functioning. Fun.
So I've brought you on the podcast today to discuss stimming, because from when I started looking more into autism advocates online and just people who were openly autistic, obviously it came across you and the amazing Twitter hashtag that you created. And then followed you on Instagram and noticed that you put a lot of stuff on there about how you stim and stimming and all that stuff. I had no idea as to what it was until probably, what month are we in now? Feb? Yeah, so nearly a year ago now. And I just wanted to get you on to explain like what stimming is and just give a bit of an insight into it and how audience can stim in like a safe way. So what is stimming?
Oh, I'm so excited about this. It's like when I first was diagnosed, stimming was one of the first things I was like, oh my gosh, there's an explanation. I was so excited because I am a very, very stimmy autistic person, especially if I am relaxed. But I was very aware once I was diagnosed that a lot of the things, especially the stimming that were, you know, defined in that diagnosis were things that I kind of bottled up often, especially when I was like in professional settings or going to work, and like I would try to be very still and this professional character I thought I had to be. And then, you know, I remember like reading about stimming and like little things like, you know, I would be in the office all day being really still and quiet, maybe tapping my foot under my desk discreetly so nobody sees what I'm doing. But the minute I go out into the hallway, like I might like jump up and down and flap my arms and do some really, really wild motions to let all that energy out. Because it just was just bottling it up and pinning it up, just trying to be still. I'm not still. My body is always just in motion. You know, it's how my emotions express. It's part of my body language. You know, for example, you know, if I'm happy, like, you know, my hands can flap like a happy little chicken. And, you know, people think it's cute sometimes. But, you know, if I'm stressed and I'm overwhelmed, and I might start like punching myself in the leg or something, that's not cute at all. That's scary, you know? So it's like stimming can be a lot of different things. But then, you know, it can be those natural things that you do to regulate either just your energy levels or, you know, your emotions. A lot of my stims are tied to my emotions. You know, fear has a very different hand flap from that happy flap I mentioned earlier. You know, the fear flap is like kind of hands more up in the air kind of a flap. But you know, I'm always moving. And with autistic people, you know, we have all of our little stims that we do naturally that we aren't even necessarily thinking about. And a lot of us, you know, when, you know, people, they see us doing something that they don't understand, especially kids in school, you know, they would pick on me for stimming. And I had horrible nicknames, and one of them was Twitchy, because I was never still. And I had a teacher, you know, that, you know, I would get in trouble for moving my hand stuff above the desk. So she said it was distracting to other kids. And so then I started doing stuff with my feet, and I learned to, like, if I did it on the floor quietly and didn't make any noise, I wouldn't get in trouble. And then I even had a teacher once that tied my feet to a chair trying to keep me from moving because she wanted me to be still, because some people think still is listening, you know, which is totally not true. Like, if I'm trying to be still, I'm probably thinking about trying to be still, and I am no longer listening. That's totally counterproductive in the school environment. But, you know, with school too, or with school, with stimming too, it's also, you know, it can be things that we intentionally seek out and do on purpose. Like, you know, when I was little, I really loved, like, pinwheels. Or I would also just lay on the floor staring at box fans or ceiling fans. It was just so relaxing. You know, and as an adult, you know, it's like maybe dancing around or singing or just, engaging in some kind of, you know, pacing maybe, or walking, just moving, keeping that movement going. That's kind of a broad overview of stimming. But it you know, it's really essential to just autistic movement and energy regulation.
So given what you know about stimming, which is quite clearly a hell of a lot more than me, what would you say the difference is between stimming and just fidgeting?
You know, honestly, a lot of it, I think, would be the frequency. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you know, I said, I personally, and a lot of autistic people, we stim more, you know, when we're regulating energy. So if we're really amped up and really excited about something, like, you might see me, like, literally jumping up and down, like, clapping my hands if I get excited enough. Like, that's a lot of energy coming out. Or, you know, you see people, maybe they aren't autistic, but they have anxiety. Yeah. And so you see anxiety, like, they wouldn't call it stimming, but you would see them, like, doing their leg under the table. And it's really the same essential function. Everybody stims, I think, and we've just given autistic stimming, like, a special name because we stim more often. But, you know, anyone, I think, especially, like, if you put them in a more stressful situation or get them excited enough, they'll probably stim in some way or another. They just don't stim all the time, because, you know, I stim all the time. And then also, you know, there's the theory that a lot of autistic people, we say, you know, that intense world theory, where maybe we experience our emotions more intensely than others. And I think that's true for me personally, you know, and it results in a lot of people sometimes saying, oh, you're overreacting, or you just need to calm down, chill out. Why are you so excited about nothing? And I'm like, why is it got to be a bad thing that I get excited about the little things? Your life sounds really boring. You know?
Yeah, no, I get that. What was it? Like, I can't remember. Like, I asked for, whenever it's like birthdays or Christmas, I ask for really rogue presents, like something really small. I'm trying to remember what the last thing I asked for was. Okay. So, as a graduation present, I got a kettle and I was buzzing. Like, I was so excited. And then my friends asked me, oh, what did you get for graduation? It's like, oh, I got a kettle, I was over the moon. And they were all like, what do you mean you got a kettle? Like, it's exactly what I wanted. It's the one I wanted. I was like overjoyed. But then they were all like, no, because obviously value signaling, that's not what you should want and all that stuff. And I was like, you know what? Me and my kettle are happy and I'm going to go make a cup of tea.
Yeah.
So how else do you stim now? Like,
well, as I'm sitting here on the podcast, I'm sitting here like rocking back and forth in a very stereotypical way. Earlier I was also doing this thing and I was like, oh, I need to stop, because I didn't know if it was gonna pick up on the microphone, where I was just tapping one hand and the other hand with two fingers. Just, you know, I do a lot of stuff with my fingers. My fingers are kind of always moving to the side of me. When it depends, honestly, on how relaxed I am. For example, unfortunately, you know, like when I was in middle school and high school, you know, people would ask me things like, are you on drugs or are you high? What are you on? You know, when they would see me like jumping around, rocking and, you know, doing all of these things. So I became really aware from that, like that, oh, some of just me being me isn't okay, you know, which is terrible. So it's like there's situations where, like, say if I was in a police station, like I'd probably like switch into that, oh my gosh, I'm like not moving anymore kind of paranoid, stiff, autistic, miserable person. Or, you know, but, you know, if I'm with my friends, I'll probably at least rock and sway. I may not do a bunch of verbal stimming, which is like making all kinds of funny little noises with my mouth and talking to myself out loud. But I do a lot of those things, like especially if I'm home alone or, you know, just David's the only one home. So it just really depends on my comfort level. But rocking is the one I do a lot. I'm very, like, I'm a hand flapper for sure. I'm definitely a hand flapper. Pacing is one. Like, sometimes, like, I'll just jump up from my chair and pace back and forth across the floor a few times and then sit back down. And a lot of, like, stuff with, like, you know, tapping my foot or my leg under the chair, just because that's kind of what I was taught in school I needed to do. Because that was the one that didn't get me in trouble. So my feet, like right now, my feet, I actually need to be careful not to unplug my laptop. My feet, you know, we're doing all kinds of stuff under the table too at the same time. So it's like, there's always something moving, even if it's just like two fingers doing an air flick, you know, it just depends.
So when I was younger, if you talk about stimming being like a sense of a way to regulate your emotions, I struggled to communicate how I was feeling, still do now, but it was more of a problem when I was younger because I didn't know that I was struggling. I just thought, like, I was stuck in my own head and stuff like that. So I used to bang my head against the wall quite regularly, which obviously isn't a safe way to stim. So have you got any suggestions for anyone who has, like, a harmful stim as to what they could replace it with? So I know some people skin pick or, like, bite their nails, like, a bit too far. Is anything like that that you could help out the listeners with?
Mm-hmm. The skin picking and then biting my lips are really bad ones that I do. Like, I will just bite my lips until they bleed. For the lips, I put chapstick on that I don't want in my mouth, and that really helps. Also, like, sometimes, like, the skin picking, like, I also used to chew on my fingers. And so I would, like, use soap I didn't like the smell of because it would keep my hands away from my face. So that was like a really random, interesting trick that I would do. But the other thing to consider is, you know, the stimming, it has a function and it does serve a purpose. And generally, it's going to be kind of in proportion to the situation. Like I said earlier, you know, like more intense stimming is more motion, or more intense emotions have like more intense stimming. So, you know, a lot of times when I am stimming in a way that is bad for me, if it's those little ones like skin picking or like biting my mouth, or maybe like I am holding my body really tense and really hard and tight, those things sometimes I realize I'm doing because I'm trying to keep myself from doing another stim that might be more obvious, but release better the energy in a more healthy way. So sometimes it's like, okay, am I holding myself still too much? Am I fighting against my natural body? Or, you know, if it's a really intense situation or a really intense emotion, I think it's been a few years since I banged my head on a wall, but, you know, being in that place is because, for me at least, you know, I was in a place of extreme agony and pain and anxiety. Or, you know, like when I slammed my hand in the door, and then my instinct was to bite my other hand because the pain in one hand was too much. But if I bit it, the other hand, I could take the brain away from that one pain. So a lot of times, you know, that intense stimming where you might actually be like, let's say if I'm like punching my legs or hitting my head on a wall, there's something else going there that's usually triggering me to act in that way. It's not just for no reason. So, you know, that energy has to go somewhere. And, you know, there's healthier ways you can get your energy out. You know, you can maybe go for a run or, you know, do some jumping jacks or something else that's very vigorous. I used to have a little, like a little just trampoline, like a little portable one. And that was really nice. But just like vigorous energy. Some people like punching bags, you know, because they're punching something that's not themselves. And that could be a really good outlet, I would think. I've never had a punching bag, but, you know, I would think sometimes just anything that's going to get big bursts of energy out at one point in time, because you can't just say, oh, just don't stim, because the stimming serves a need. There's a purpose to it. So you got to displace that energy, or you got to look at the root cause. Like, what are the emotions there? Those extreme intense emotions that have been triggered in that person that have caused them to be in this place where they are in extreme distress. And people forget that.
You've had a pretty, sounds to me like you've had a pretty, stereotypical office job where you had to try and regulate yourself in your stims. This was talking about probably prior to your diagnosis. So in what ways do you think someone in that kind of setting could release their energy in a safe way?
Yeah, well, what was really helpful for me when I did physically go to the office was I did, you know, because most employers, they're supposed to let you take, you know, 10 and 15 minute breaks a couple times a day here and there. So whenever I did those and the weather was nice, I would often go and walk around the neighborhood of our office and the building. And of course, that depends on if you're in a safe neighborhood, of course. Or, you know, sometimes I would, if the weather wasn't good, I would go sit in my car and rock out to some music I really liked, because music has just always been one of my number one go-tos for regulation. So go dance alone in my car and look ridiculous and sing loudly and off key to some music that sets the mood, you know, reset the brain. And I also, you know, especially when you have a job, when you're not moving, or at least when I do, especially if it's a job that requires a lot of mental energy. And a lot of jobs nowadays require a lot of agility, which is something autistic people can struggle with, you know, being able to, you know, employers want us to be able to adapt and make on the spot changes. And that can be really stressful and just, you know, wears on you. And so just all of that, just making sure when I'm wearing my brain down that hard, I have to make an effort to counterbalance that with physical activity, because otherwise I get really dysregulated, and it's, you know, where my brain is just mush and worn down and just not working and tired, and then my body almost like feels like it's got way too much energy still left in it. And it's hard to really even put it into words, but it's a horrible feeling. And I've noticed that if I don't move and, you know, maybe exercise or go for walks or make a point to make sure I'm supplementing all the time I'm sitting still with activities where I'm counterbalancing some of that physical body energy, it ruins my life.
So do you find it has an impact on your sleep at night then?
Oh my gosh, yes. But my sleep is tricky. I think I've had to, like, there's a formula and all the conditions have to be like met for perfect sleep. So it starts with, I can't have caffeine very often or very much caffeine, and if I do, it needs to not be after lunchtime, you know, and I love coffee, so that's terrible, but, you know, it's okay, it's worth it. I've noticed that I am actually really sensitive to like blue light.
Okay.
So when I worked in the office and they had fluorescent lighting, that blue lighting really made me sick. And it gave me all kinds of neurological issues, but then, you know, my insomnia was worse with it. And insomnia triggered other problems I have with my health, because I really need to get enough sleep to be healthy. And then I also, like, I need to go to bed, like, and get up at the same time every day. Mm-hmm. I just really need to. I have to have that routine. And now that I've, like, I meet all of those conditions regularly, and it's like, people are like, come on, can't you come out? It's the weekend. It's, come on, you can stay out late. It's like, no, I really need to go to bed on time. Like, it's really important. Every now and then I might stay up late, but getting this on track, it's like, I didn't know I could get good night sleeps, you know? And I can, but I didn't know that for almost like 20 some odd years of my life, because my sleep cycle is really delicate and really sensitive. And I'm also a really light sleeper, unfortunately.
Oh gosh, it must be difficult being in an RV.
No, not too bad, actually, believe it or not. It's more annoying with the dogs because, you know, they're like getting in the bed with you and like all up in your face and you're trying to sleep. And like, you know, your dog rolls over and like kicks you in the mouth when you're sleeping.
So while you're here, I think we'd have a quick talk about your wonderful hashtag and just let me know how it all started.
Yeah. Asking autistics.
Yeah.
So a lot of that, you know, and that actually goes back to almost when I was freshly diagnosed. That was such a long time ago. And it makes me really happy to see that it's still growing. And a lot of people don't even know I created it. Like most people have no idea. I'm kind of impressed. You've done your homework. But it, you know, that started because, you know, when I was diagnosed with, you know, how I mentioned my diagnosing doctor put me on that path towards reading other autistic voices. Mm-hmm. But, you know, after I was done with the books she'd recommended and I wanted to go find more because, you know, I know there are blogs, you know, there's always blogs about everything on the internet. I started looking and I couldn't find the information that was from autistic people. I could find, you know, the Big Blue Puzzle People and a few others, and all of it was very medicalized. And there was nobody giving the first person's perspective. That was what I had related to and found myself in those books and those stories from those autistic authors early on. And it was so difficult to find. And I had so many questions still. And so, you know, it was an answer to those questions. But then also, you know, a really big reason there was asking autistics, because I'd also already found Actually Autistic, which is, you know, a really good one too, but that, you know, that's not mine, that's been around for a while. There's a lot of people who either maybe they don't know they're autistic yet, or maybe they're parents or caregivers for autistic people, and they had questions just like I did. But, you know, if you know, the Actually Autistic tag is intended only for autistic people to use. So there was a bit of a problem before Asking Autistics where, you know, parents and people who were really well-meaning and wanting to interact with the community would use the wrong hashtag, but they didn't really have a hashtag they could use to ask us questions. So that was, you know, the main thing is like, okay, I need a hashtag that anyone who wants to ask an autistic person a question can use. And so that's really, you know, why it was born. It was because, you know, my number one driving factor in my life is the question why. Like every time I come into any kind of situation, my immediate like response in my head is why? And so, you know, asking people questions, you know, it annoyed people when I was a kid growing up, but it's been a beneficial skill as an adult, thank goodness.
So how does the hashtag look now compared to how it used to look when you, well, how it did when you first created it, like in terms of its use and things like that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's become self-sustaining, which is nice, which is really nice because when it first started, a lot of it, you know, was me going in and retweeting the other accounts and the other people and just retweeting anyone who had a question so that it could get bigger reach and get traction. Because at the time I had one of the larger, I guess I still do have one of the largest.
Definitely still do.
Twitter accounts. But I mean, I think back then I had like 7,000 or 9,000 followers, which is, it seemed like a lot to me back then. And like now actually, like I think it's 20 something and it's like, oh my gosh, it's really actually very overwhelming sometimes if I think about it too much. But you know, I also noticed it's like, it used to only be on Twitter and I'm seeing it other places. Like it's catching on Instagram too. And, so I think even if I don't do anything with it at this point, it's going to keep growing and it's off in the world. It's like, oh, my baby's growing up. I don't, you know, it's become its own thing. It's not even really mine anymore. You know, it's become property of the community, which is exactly what it was intended for. And so that really does make me happy because I think it really helps connect people.
It definitely has. It really helped me at the beginning of my, well, to be fair, it wasn't the beginning of my diagnosis journey, it was just the beginning of my realization last year, like, that autism does have a massive impact on my life and being autistic has changed the way I experience the world. So we've had a great chat today and I really want to thank you for coming on and for creating that wonderful hashtag. Is there anything else you want to mention to the listeners? Anything you've got coming up?
You know, nothing particularly special right now. I mean, we're getting into April next month, so I'm just getting geared up to start doing more of the public speaking and all of that. I like teaching, you know, that's really what this is all about. Teaching. I love teaching. I don't really want to be a leader or anything. I just want to teach. Just let me like write things and teach and talk about autism. You know, that's where my happy place is. And so like this month I'm doing a bunch of writing. I am writing a book though, but it's going to be a while before that's out. It's a tell-all memoir. And there will probably be two versions of the book because there's a chapter of my life and a chapter of the book, that is a bit intense. And the themes may be too much for some readers. And so I'm thinking that some readers or young readers may not want to read that part. So I'll be leaving that out in one version of the book, I think, once it's ready. I'm only about 50 pages in right now, but, you know, I'm hoping to have about 150 to 200 pages when I'm done. But it's like, you know, I get another 5 or 10 pages every week and I know it'll be done before I know it. So I can't wait. I hope it will be helpful and useful to others. You know, as I'm writing my book, I'm thinking a lot about the books that I read when I was first discovering what being autistic really meant to me. My goal, you know, is to write something that will be able to be helpful and useful to people like those books were to me when I was first starting out.
That's amazing. So yeah, thank you for coming on today. I will leave a link to the books that you mentioned earlier in the show notes, as well as to your Twitter account. And do you have a, I swear you've got a Patreon. Is that not a Patreon?
I do have a Patreon. I'm Neurodivergent Rebel everywhere. The only exception is Twitter because it's Neuro Rebel. I think Neurodivergent Rebel was too long.
Too long. Twitter's so dumb. It only lets you have like 15 characters. It's really annoying.
And that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me. If you want to get involved in the conversation, then obviously there's the YouTube comments, but we've also got the Adulting Autistic chat room now. So you can join that. Just head over to chat.adultingautistic.com. It is linked in the show notes as well. And we'll discuss what's happened in this episode and just have a general chit chat. Like, it's a pretty cool forum. So yeah, I'll be back next week with YouTuber Yo Samly Sam, where we talk about motherhood and having a sense of belonging because she's like moved around a lot. But yeah, it should be cool. I will be in your ears again next week. Bye.